so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game? Yeah!
Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah. Let's do this, man. It's another Toy Department. I am Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. I really should have done this in my sad intro today, Matt.
Yeah, man.
I kind of screwed that up. I was excited to be doing the podcast, and then I was like, oh, yeah, it's a sad day.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're still waiting for some details, but...
we're not, actually, unfortunately.
Oh, it's... Yeah. They ruled it.
Yeah, by the way, so if you're, you know, listening to this on like a Wednesday and wondering what we're talking about, we're recording this on a Thursday morning. Chris Cornell passed away last night. And it's now, at least according to the Hollywood Reporter, officially been ruled suicide by hanging. Which was...
Man alive.
Yeah. Particularly rough. I mean, look, it's all rough, you know? There's no good thing. It's weird.
You don't want to rank death or especially rank suicide, but it just seems like the state of mind you have to be in to do something that extreme and violent to yourself is,
you
can only imagine.
It just doesn't square. And look, I understand that's part of suicide. Like, it doesn't have to make sense.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, from the outside, you know, for people that you don't know. But, I just saw Soundgarden 4 days ago. I saw Soundgarden, they looked and sounded great and were vital.
Yeah. He sounded great. He has sounded great over the last couple years.
Yeah. I mean,
just in general.
Peak. His voice is in peak condition. It was an excellent show. And, I'd read an article where he was talking about doing more things with Temple of the Dog this year. It seemed like he had plans, you know? He's got
That's what's so shocking to me is you know, look, a lot of musicians are troubled. We know that Chris Cornell has had his issues over the years. But he seemed in his 50s to have really reclaimed his life, to have really... be in control and be positive and happy and doing things and moving forward and making new music. And it's really hard to understand.
Yeah. I happened to revisit Pearl Jam's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on HBO the other night. And it does sort of make you appreciate the place that those guys and Eddie in particular were able to get to later in life. Maybe, you know, you could argue intentionally sort of slowing down the machine at the height of their fame, but you know, they're in a place where they seem comfortable and happy and well adjusted, and literally all of their peers are now gone, and it's kind of crazy. And you know, the other thing too that's very prominent in that is that a couple of guys in Pearl Jam mentioned Soundgarden not being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I have to think there are people associated with that group who are sitting around going, man, we kind of blew up by not putting those guys in before Chris was gone, you know. They've been eligible. They've been eligible a lot longer than Pearl Jam or Nirvana.
Because they had much earlier albums, right?
Yeah.
They had an 89 album, didn't they?
I bought my first Soundgarden record in 89, and that was not their debut. So I want to say they had an 86 or 87 record, something like that. So, they were there even before Alice in Chains, who are also not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, I kind of wonder, because I think that's something that probably will happen at some point, and maybe sadly now it'll happen a little faster, but...
Yeah, it's a real shame.
You know, just one of the defining voices, you know, particularly if you're talking about, you know, I don't mean that in the Bob Dylan voice of a generation term. I mean that in the...
Literal, his voice.
His literal voice. It so incredible. So much range. and, you know, just a quintessential sort of rock pattern. You know, there are a lot of singers out there who imitated Eddie Vedder and Scott Weiland because, those, you know, you can do that. That's the thing you can do. Like,
no one's, yeah, no one's imitating Chris Cornell.
Yeah, it's just really, it's really hard to be Chris Cornell. And as a guy who's sung Hunger Strike at karaoke a few times, I can tell you that that's very true, for, at least for me.
yeah, well, and just like, not to say that guys like Eddie Vedder aren't incredibly distinctive in their own right, but I remember when the first Audioslave record came out, and I feel like it had been a while since we'd really heard much from Chris Cornell at that point. And just hearing his voice, like, he, I'm not sure there's anyone, at least in my lifetime, I think you go back to maybe a Robert Plant, but of the voices of my lifetime, he stands for me above the rest by a margin.
Yeah. I went to see him a couple of years ago. He was doing an acoustic tour. It was just him and mm-hmm. one other guy, playing acoustic guitar, piano. And, you realize that, you know, between Soundgarden and Audioslave, and then you throw in Temple of the Dog, and really kind of an underrated solo career, that he had built up this really huge and varied body of work that he could have pulled, a lot of really great songs from. And, you know, when I saw Soundgarden this weekend, they played Black Hole Sun fourth, you know?
Right.
Like, Black Hole Sun is...
it's an encore song for every other band.
Like, that's a generational song, you know what I mean? And they're dropping it fourth in the set like it's no big deal, and it kind of was, because there were plenty more, there were hits that preceded it, and there were plenty more hits that were going to follow.
Right.
And I got to tell you, like, just the, you know, I was lucky enough to be standing side stage around a lot of bands, and the reverence that every band on that bill had for Soundgarden was amazing. I talked for a while with the Pretty Reckless, who were opening.
Wait a second.
What?
You talked with the Pretty Reckless?
I know.
why isn't Taylor Momsen on our podcast right now?
I tried to book it right then, but it's weird. She had things to do. She was going on tour with Soundgarden.
like, do you have her number? Because we don't have to have her on the podcast, but I'd like to talk to her.
Okay. Maybe we'll make that happen for you later. Taylor, right. Taylor was very
like
nice.
That.
Huge, huge Soundgarden fan. In fact, she told me that Soundgarden's what they would play, you know, their headline shows or whatever. That's what they would play to, you know, warm up in the dressing room. And they were a little freaked out that they weren't going to be able to play their regular warm up music opening up for Soundgarden because it might seem weird. So they had to get Chris's okay to
so
do so.
Funny.
Their crew was wearing Soundgarden T-shirts. They knew exactly where they were when they got the call to do the tour, and it was just a couple of dates. Like, that's the kind of reverence rock bands have for that band and what they mean to people. And I'm just, you know, to have that kind of snatched away so suddenly, it's rough, man. It's rough. Like, a lot of my heroes are gone, you know, like, these are people that,
well, and you know, last
do
year,
this, you know,
last year we had so many heroes leave us, and some of them, I mean, look, no doubt far too soon, but that was a previous generation to Chris Cornell.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really, it was not time for these guys to start going. It's not time for that yet.
Right. And that's a thing. And, you know, look, obviously Prince went a little early, but, like, Prince, you know, and I was alive for a lot of Prince, but Prince was really mm-hmm. like a generation up from us, right?
Yes. Same thing with Bowie. He was younger than 70. I mean, no one wants to die at the age that he died, but it felt like a complete life and career in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I would say Chris Cornell very much does not feel that way.
Yeah. So
can I awkwardly transition us? Because when I said you spoke to the Pretty Reckless, it sounded like you were bracing for me to criticize you.
I wasn't. No, I was I was bracing for you to criticize me for name dropping.
not for, oh, no, not no, no. Okay. Where are you on the Pretty Reckless?
Where am I on the Pretty Reckless? That's a really excellent question.
I think so too. I find them to be a really interesting rock band, like positionally, philosophically, if that makes sense, because they're not necessarily doing anything new. They're very much in the Soundgarden vein, frankly. And, yeah. And Taylor Momsen, who, if people don't know, was a lead character on Gossip Girl before becoming the lead singer of a hard rock band, which is just like the coolest career path I've ever heard of, and I'm in love with her.
Yeah. And she is, you know, like, this is not one of those things where, you know, she's Kevin Bacon or...
Right, no, well, that's what I was going to say is she totally left the acting thing. Yeah. She was like, I'm not really into being incredibly attractive on screen. I actually love rock music. And she really hasn't even used her acting fame to push the rock band at all. Like, she really seems to have wanted to make the Pretty Reckless stand on its own as a rock group. Well, and I think they do. I mean, I don't know that, again, they're not breaking new ground, but each time they release an album, I listen to it and find like at least four or five songs that I'm like, damn, this really rocks and it's really good.
We talked about that It quality, right? Like,
Yeah. Well, she has it.
She absolutely has it. Like you know, you can't take your eyes off of her when she's out there, and she can work a crowd. She has the vibe. And so, yeah, so I, you know, some of their records I like more than others, but seeing them live, I was really impressed by the Pretty Reckless.
I love to hear that. I would like to see them. And I do also think it's noteworthy that the entire cross section of Gossip Girl and Pretty Reckless fans may be on this podcast right now.
Well, I'm not a Gossip Girl fan.
I'm just talking about myself.
Oh, you okay? Gotcha.
I'm exclusively referring to myself.
All right.
I think I'm the only one.
Then that's a fair point. That is indeed a fair point. All right. I may have a few more off podcast stories for you later.
Okay. All right.
I have to keep them off the record, sadly.
I'm excited and trepidatious. Is that a word?
Yeah, trepidatious is a word.
Cool.
All right.
I mean, I know I can feel trepidation, but I wasn't sure if trepidatious was
yes.
a word.
Yes, that's the quality of having trepidation.
And I even used it correctly.
Indeed. Chris Cornell, you would miss. Should we flip the script and talk about Master of None? That'd be a little bit lighter. Let's talk about Master of None. The new season premiered on Netflix Friday.
Something like that.
And the binging has begun. Do you find it tough, like, you know, having conversations, you know, with people besides me about shows like this? Because you're just trying to find someone who's at the point where you're at. You know what I mean?
This is the chief difficulty of the binge TV era and process.
Yeah.
I much prefer to binge as an individual human being. But as is evidenced by this podcast and my day-to-day life, I also like to talk about the things that I watch. And it makes it binging, the Netflix model of releasing it all at once and letting people watch when they can is great for absolutely everything except discussion outside of your living room.
Right. But I mean, that's such a key part
it is.
Of things, you know?
And I think especially for a show like Master of None that is like talky and thinky.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot in here that is speaking directly to my generation, or maybe a little bit younger, but I fancy myself youthful. And I have thoughts and I want to talk to people about it, and it becomes very difficult. Because you inevitably are like, oh, where are you at? Oh, I'm at episode 8. Oh, I'm at episode 6. Oh, right. Well, I don't want to ruin anything. All right, well, let's circle back on this. And you never circle back.
And then you don't. Do you also, my other binge issue, and this is particularly true with comedies, and really true with something like, say, Catastrophe, where it's like only 6 episodes, is like you power through them and you're fired up and you're excited about the show. And then it's like, oh crap, now they're done. And it's a year and a half before we get any more of these, right? You know? And you kind of have that ate the whole box of Girl Scout cookies vibe at the end of it, you know?
Oh, that's funny. Because for me, the fact that I ate the whole box of Girl Scouts, the only vibe I get at the end is like the depression of a fat kid. I don't feel regret that there aren't more. I feel nothing but regret that they're all inside of me.
Oh, gotcha.
Headed for my stomach. And
I feel like I ate all the Samoas, and it's another year before there are more Samoas around, you know?
Oh, no. See, by the time I'm done with a box of Samoas, which I do eat in one sitting, unquestionably, I then think to myself, thank God there are no more Samoas around.
Because I'd eat those, too.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
but putting that aside, I am less bothered by that because there's so much.
It does.
You know, when I finish Master of None, I know I still have three episodes of Catastrophe and, you know, more leftovers on the way. And there's an Orange is the New Black season coming. And, you know, like I just in today's TV landscape never have the feeling of what am I going to watch? So experiencing some of these shows more the way you'd experience a film where you watch it, it's over. And like if there's more, it's a year or two away.
Yeah.
I'm OK with that part. But the trickiness of not knowing who to talk to. Is
rough.
Or like what things you can say, because inevitably if you start trying to have the conversation without spoiling things, like that doesn't go well.
Right. Maybe I just
either it's a dumb conversation or you end up spoiling something.
Yeah, maybe I just want more episodes of Catastrophe. Maybe that's what it comes down to. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's a very that's a British television thing more than a binge thing, though,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, come on, Brits, get it together.
On the other hand, like if the goal is to leave them wanting more, they're doing it right, and America is not.
That's true. So we are slightly out of sync on Master of None, right? You're on episode 7 or 8.
I finished 7 of them. Yeah.
Okay. So I've finished 6. So I think that's close enough that we can talk about it.
It is, although I will say, episode 7 was noteworthy.
Wow. I feel like episode 6 was noteworthy. Maybe I'm really on 7, and we're you know, I think one of the things that was really cool about the season, one of my favorite things about this season, are you know, some of the more experimental episodes. There's a really great episode that's about New York in a way that features almost no Aziz. It's kind of like the episode about the
that
people
is episode
that
6.
That's the episode about the people you don't notice. Yes. Okay. So I've seen that. That was, and I loved it.
That's the last one you saw.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe that's the one I was thinking of too.
Okay. Good. but either way.
Oh, yeah. No. 7. Okay. You're right. That is the one I was thinking of. 7 is very funny, but 6 is the one I was thinking of. It's very, very interesting to have a television show based around one character with several other side characters you know, and then to, with no warning or apparent provocation, have a whole episode where those characters are essentially not in it. And that episode also featured, and this is a slight spoiler, but I don't think it should ruin much, it featured, I would say, about a 6-minute sequence following deaf people around New York.
Yeah.
Where there was no sound whatsoever.
No sound.
Which was incredibly jarring, but also, I thought, in the end, beautifully done.
I thought it was beautifully done, too. I also feel like you're sort of leaving out in the jarring experience that the conversation, the audioless conversation that they were having, was filthy.
Oh, yeah. Very, very, very dirty deaf conversation. A lot of, I learned how to say vagina in sign language, which is cool for me.
Yeah.
I also thought the gag where they had the lady come up and say, hey, my kids know sign language, would you stop talking about your vagina, was pretty excellent.
Yeah, that was, and completely out of nowhere. Yeah, it's a great show. It's really funny. It's really smart. It has things to say about both the human condition and food. And
a lot about food
and about love and life. Yeah. and it makes these points in a way that's not super strident, you know,
right,
but always entertaining.
Well, it does a thing also that I shouldn't say it. Aziz does a thing that I've only ever seen successfully accomplished by Jerry Seinfeld, which is he's just not even really acting. And the difference between Aziz and Jerry Seinfeld is I think Aziz is a pretty darn good actor.
Yeah, I think Aziz pulls that off better than Seinfeld did. Yeah.
Well, Seinfeld just couldn't act. Right. So he was just reading lines in a goofy way. But this is a choice for Aziz.
Right.
Where he's chosen to be this character who, like, says things in a sort of... I don't even know how to explain it. He says things like Jerry Seinfeld. The way he talks on this show is like is not really how a person talks, I guess is the best way to explain it. I don't – it's hard for me to pin it down, but there's a thing about his tone that feels almost like he's reading lines.
Yeah.
But it's clearly, again, because you've seen him in plenty of places act as a different person, it's clearly a choice that he's made. And I just find it – I find it – to somehow it adds to the entire experience where it's like – and I think maybe it's easier for him to become the avatar of the audience by not filling himself in too much. Yeah. Does that make sense?
I can see that. I kind of buy that, I think.
He's a pretty general character.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, like, a lot of times the main character of a show like this.
Specifics of his background and things like that that are sort of, that are very kind of specific. You know what I mean? You think about the pork episode, you know what I mean? Like, that is not a.
Oh, sure.
So there's nothing general about that episode or about Dev in that episode.
No, that's true. Philosophically, no question. And there's, the next episode. I mean, the whole religion episode, certainly. But. I do think even in that religion episode, it's not the development of the character that's rote or general. It's the way he behaves.
Yeah.
It's the delivery of the lines. And I think in a way that kind of allows him to serve even when he's in a situation like with the pork. You know, which for people who haven't seen it, he there's a whole episode about he's comes from a Muslim family and he's not really observing the religion. And even in that, where it's clearly about a Muslim Indian, his generality as a character on a second to second basis makes me feel like he brings everybody into it and he sort of lets us all feel it. And I also just want to mention, we talked about the New York I Love You episode. There's also a first date episode that is the most brilliant depiction of first date feelings that I've ever seen, where essentially it's one first date with 20 different women or something. And anybody who has been a regular dater in modern times identified with that unquestionably.
Yeah, for sure.
That you, in order to have a functional dating life in 2017, it feels like you have to have a game plan and an approach and
like some handy conversation topics.
Exactly. You find yourself in the same places, eating the same meals, having the same conversations with different people. And it's just, they did such an incredible job of portraying that. Well, anytime someone makes a successful artistic thing that's more than its face, I think of this line from Tim O'Brien in a book called The Things They Carried, which is a short story book about Vietnam, where he basically says, sometimes to tell the truth, you have to lie. And like art like this, what Aziz does in both The New York I Love You and the first date episode especially, but just something that has been a characteristic of this show all along is that he finds ways to tell you universally understandable and identifiable stories in the framework of the show that he's created.
Yeah. I'll give you two more things that I really liked. One, just really simply the ride home in the cab alone.
It was like 3 minutes of you're just looking at him and look at the world.
He's just kind of sighing and thinking, and sorting out his feelings, and the camera just stays on him the whole time. And that's such a real moment that everyone's had, and almost any other show would yada 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 that.
Right. And you have to have a conversation. He calls someone on his cell phone. He talks to the cabbie, whatever it is.
Right, right, right.
They would either add to it or they would get rid of the scene entirely.
Right. And for them to just stay with that and allow it to conclude the episode, but I thought was just really that was a moment, and it was a, you felt like you were in it. And I guess that sort of leads into the other thing, in that I think that this show just fully draws the world that it's in, whether it's New York or the first couple of episodes in Italy. Like, it's a fantasized version of both of those places, but you really feel like the details, you really feel like you're there. It's aware of the culture and the vibe, and it gets those details right. And it's really quite a show. I'm probably going to power through the remaining seven episodes or whatever very quickly, and then I'm going to have the Girl Scout cookie feeling.
Yeah, I have horrible news for you. You have at most four episodes.
There's only four left.
There's only 10 in the season.
God.
I take it back, because this is one where I will probably have the Girl Scout, your Girl Scout cookie feeling a little bit, not my Girl Scout cookie feeling, of there should be more. And that's rare for me. I don't feel that every show that comes on. I actually am starting to, even though I've enjoyed blasting through it and getting to where we are, and actually we didn't mention this, but we could talk about this show today as well. I feel like when The Leftovers ends, I'll be like, all right. I feel like when even Game of Thrones, which I'm desperate to see more of in many ways, I feel like when it ends, I'll be like, okay. Mostly when Orange is the New Black, which I really like. When it ends, usually I'm like, all right, that was a season of Orange is the New Black. I liked it. But this is definitely one where I'm like, not enough.
Yeah. All right. So should we move on to Better Call Saul?
Yes.
Were feeling really good about episode six of Better Call Saul, at least you felt like you had something you wanted to talk about.
I'm feeling great about it. I think the show, I was probably being overly reactive after episode one or two when I was like, are we still in it? But man, am I totally sold right now. I think it is probably the best, generally speaking, the best cast performance that I'm watching regularly on television right now. I think Bob Odenkirk is brilliant. The lady whose name I never remember, who plays his girlfriend, is one of my favorite.
Seahorn?
Yeah. She's one of my favorite actresses that is not in enough things. I think she's spectacular. What's Giancarlo Esposito? I so enjoy seeing him from this side, because in Breaking Bad, it was all waiting for the ruthless drug kingpin to come out. It was, who is this guy? And eventually it happened. But to dive in with him, where from Jump Street, essentially, you're like, this is a dangerous man doing dangerous things, I find thrilling. And in addition to that, I feel like they, through a court case and a nonviolent drug dispute, have ratcheted up the intensity and excitement and sort of crowd-pleasing nature nearly to Breaking Bad levels, which is quite an achievement in my eyes. I also found the one thing that I'm not sure I love, or it's not even that I don't love. The one thing I'm not totally sure how to feel about after this week is I feel zero sympathy for his brother. What's his brother's name? Michael McKean, whatever his name is. Chuck.
Chuck.
Zero. Zero. He's not a sympathetic figure to me at all. And I find myself wondering if the show wants me to pity him.
I think I do find him somewhat of a sympathetic figure. I think he genuinely loves and cares for Jimmy. I do.
Oh, I don't. Why do you
think
that?
He's proud, you know what I mean? And kind of petty. And so they're going to sort of bump up against each other as rivals. You know what I mean?
See, I see a brother who has been threatened and vengeful ever since his younger sibling that he saw himself as superior to deigned to get a law degree. And I see a guy who has consistently undercut his brother every possible chance, despite his brother going above and beyond any reasonable expectation to care for a severely mentally ill man who refuses to admit to his own disease.
Well, I think you're definitely looking at that from Saul's perspective. You know what I mean?
To a degree, but I don't know what other perspective there is.
Well, there's Chuck's perspective.
But that's the perspective of a mentally ill person who's right, clueless about his surroundings.
Don't we normally have sympathy for mentally ill people who are clueless about their surroundings?
Okay. I have a modicum of sympathy for his mental illness, but it's not.
This is a guy who had a very pretty rich, full life.
That's right.
And it's completely fallen apart, you know?
That's right, because his wife left him and he refused to seek any help over it. And to me, that's not like the pity I feel or the genuine concern I feel for someone who's stricken with schizophrenia or bipolar disease or depression. This is a person who has failed to process his own emotions. He's an emotional child, and instead of trying to deal with it or letting anyone help him in a meaningful way, he has forced his younger brother to help him in an unhelpful way and to capitulate to his absurdity. And then after years of surviving exclusively on the mercy of his younger brother, deliberately tried to ruin that brother's life. And to me, he's despicable, frankly. And I found myself thinking, I hope he falls in the street and ends up hospitalized when he was walking down the street with his fake allergy, because we know it's not real.
Look, just because it's not real doesn't mean he's not experiencing it as real. You know what I mean?
Okay, but again, once it was proven to him that it wasn't real, how is your answer to continue to antagonize your brother?
You're trying to provide rationality for a person with mental illness. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't feel like his mental illness in this case is driving his irrationality. Right. His mental illness exists, but he's being independently irrational from my perspective.
I have a different view. I'm not saying that Chuck is great and awesome and whatever. He and Jimmy are the same. They're the same. But your sympathy is 100% with Jimmy because the story is told from Jimmy's perspective. That's my only point. They're the same.
I don't think they are the same.
They do the same crap to each other. They've been doing it all their lives. So
yeah, I disagree.
That's my perspective on it.
I disagree. I draw a pretty big distinction between the hapless, lovable loser and the
but he's not pointed. He's none of those things. I mean, yeah, maybe he's lovable.
He is absolutely those things.
He's not hapless. He's certainly not hapless.
He's hapless in as much as he can't stay out of his own way.
Yeah, well, that's a you know, I guess that's a character flaw.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I and again, this is not about me painting Jimmy McGill or Saul Goodman, as it were, as a flawless protagonist.
Yeah.
I just find where I thought that for the first season, two seasons, and maybe even the beginning of this one, I felt like there was a deliberate effort to make them seem more the same and to split your sympathy and to make it difficult. I feel like that has gone out the window with these court proceedings, because we've seen again and again that Chuck is more interested in ruining Jimmy's career and life than he is in anything else.
Yeah.
Like, he deliberately blocked him from getting the job there. He has thrown up roadblocks for his own brother, a brother who once again has been altruistically caring for him during a protracted mental illness.
Have you not had a friend that you like and you want to do well, but you know that you wouldn't necessarily want them to work with you because you feel like it might reflect poorly on you? You've never been in that situation?
I have certainly been in that situation.
Okay, so then
however,
you say this
that
like
is not the situation.
I think that's why he tried to keep him from working at the firm.
He'd already been working at the firm, and
sympathy is
hold
not
on,
with
hold
Jimmy.
Hold on, wait. Let me rephrase
it's
answer
not
to your
Chuck.
Question.
It's I don't
let
I don't
me change
have to
my answer
either
because
one
I have not been in that situation, Derek.
Okay,
I have been in a situation where someone has needed my. We should definitely hire this guy to get a job. And I would be unwilling to do that. I have never been in a situation where someone earned a job on their own merits and I would block them. Never in my life. I would never consider doing that. And I certainly wouldn't consider doing that to my brother. If I was doing that to someone, it would be because I thought they were the worst person in the world and didn't want to be around them for minute one. But Jimmy did not need Chuck's help to get the job. Chuck had to go out of his way to block him from getting the job. There is a big difference between those two things in my eyes. Big difference.
All right. Look, I'm
we've gone too far down the rabbit hole of me excoriating Chuck McGill. But
yes, we have.
but that's an interesting twist for me in a show that I love. I do feel like, and maybe it's the side issue of as Jimmy falls further down into Saul Goodman and does more and more shady stuff, the show changes perspective more and more to make it seem like he's not the bad guy.
I don't think anyone's the bad guy, except maybe Hector. Hector seems like he's probably the bad guy.
Yeah. But again, that side of it is now just as interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I love watching the, like they told some backstory for Nacho this week. I mean, there's just, you talked about Master of None painting its world so well. I don't know if anyone does it better than Vince Gilligan.
Yeah. I mean, I think what Master of None has done is sort of impressive in that it's done it in kind of less time. You know,
and
I mean?
In comedy, which is just a less it feels less necessary to paint the world out the way they do. So it feels more impressive. But I find myself so often in Better Call Saul wondering, like, man, did they have this aspect of his backstory when they were making Breaking Bad? Because it really does fit.
Yeah, I don't know. I think some of the Nacho stuff really does date from that, and they just kind of fleshed it out a little bit.
Right.
But I don't know. All right, so you watched another episode of a show that I have not watched, so I think this will be an interesting discussion. I won't be able to defend any of the characters in A Handmaid's Tale.
But a lot of them deserve criticism, but let's not do that.
I am excited to see it because
you are
Elizabeth Moss is the god. You know what I mean?
Like, no, I don't, because I've never really watched an Elizabeth Moss show.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, so here are some things.
I understand this is the new consensus. Elizabeth Moss is the greatest television actress of our times.
Here are some things that Elizabeth Moss has been in.
I found each and every show she's on to be virtually unwatchable.
West Wing?
Couldn't ever get into it. Found it almost unwatchable.
Oh, wow. I love West Wing.
To be fair, I tried West Wing less than most of these other ones.
I mean, if there was like Sorkin was like, we're doing a West Wing revival right now, like I would be in so fast. All right, so West Wing, you're out on that. Mad Men, obviously
now
you're out on that.
I have tried again and again, and I am 100. Like West Wing, you could convince me to watch. Mad Men, absolutely not.
Wow. All right, we may have to talk about that at some point. That may be a whole special pod.
I watched like 8 episodes of it. It's boring. It's boring and dumb. I get it. They're all dressed like they're in the 50s. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's definitely the point of the show, is we're all dressed like we're in the 50s. That's the whole show.
It was
show, right?
8 episodes, and that was enough to turn me off forever.
All right. Well, you're missing out. Top of the Lake.
Never heard of it.
All right. That's you're getting homework. You're getting homework, and that's to watch Top of the Lake. Or at least watch one episode of Top of the Lake.
It's a show? Top of the Lake?
Yeah.
Like a body of water?
Top of the Lake. It's Elizabeth Moss is a cop investigating a murder in New Zealand, and it has that British structure. I think it's only 6 episodes. So,
all right.
But yeah, great murder mystery, and she's fantastic in it.
I'll write this down. Top of the Lake.
and so different from Peggy Olson. The work that she does with in Mad Men, you know, in a show like that that's so interior, and the relationship that she and Don Draper build, you know, from an acting perspective is like, she's great. She's great. And she
To be clear, I'm not criticizing Elizabeth Moss. I'm just saying I don't know her from.
She generally picks good projects. So I'm, so when she's in something, I'm excited. I am excited about this. Right. Everything I hear, though, is that it's a tough watch. So,
what do you know about The Handmaid's Tale?
I know very little, other than it's just like a little dystopian, a little science fictiony. There's some like religious thing happening. That's pretty much what I know at this point.
All right. Well, mild spoiler alerts, but after one episode, the addition to that we know is basically, yes, it is a world run, or at least a place that she's stuck in, run by a religious cult. That religious cult it seems like we're in a future where the birth rate dropped shockingly low to the point where it became a concern, and the world was taken over, essentially, it seems, by a religious cult who uses fertile women as breeders, essentially, and rich elite families with barren matriarchs, their husbands, in a very bizarre and uncomfortable ceremony, impregnate or attempt to impregnate the breeder women while their barren wives sit there and then do all the other stuff and enjoy all the benefits of being in a high station, married to a important man in the religious cult. Okay. So, yeah, it's a hard watch. There are some flashbacks to before the cult took over sort of things, where you see sort of, I assume we're going to see over time how we got here. But it's sort of cutting back and forth between essentially modern times and this dystopian future where a religious cult is in control. Given that, and ignoring the fact that, yes, you obviously want to watch Elizabeth Moss, does that interest you at all?
Yeah. I mean, look, that doesn't sound like the most fun when I have, Master of None and Dear White People waiting for me to kind of finish. But yeah, yeah. I'd be interested in that. I like things that are dark and depressing sometimes. So
yeah. Well, in that case, I think we should definitely watch it and talk about it. I mean, I think that's probably enough for now. I will say, I'm not 100% sure if I was not talking about television on a podcast that I would watch any more of this. But that is not because it was not good. It's looks incredible. Elizabeth Moss is really good. Joseph Fiennes shows up in a very strange role that I'm sure we'll get a lot more of. Samira Wiley, who I love, plays an interesting part. I think it has the potential to be a beautifully shot, excellent television show, but it is a real downer. And I would add that it feels especially ominous given the current political environment.
All right. Fair enough. Let's jump into maybe some sports things real quick. And then we'll get out of here before we get too depressing. All right. So NBA. Where are you as, you know, now kind of like in these playoffs as everyone else seems to be?
I mean, I never really like, okay. I understand the vast majority of these playoffs have been uninteresting. When we've talked about it in the past, I've chosen to seize on because I watched virtually every game of this playoffs. I was really able to enjoy series like Memphis and San Antonio, even if it was only six games, there were some incredible games, there were some incredible battles. By the same token, I really enjoyed Washington Boston. I will say, given what happened last night and the fact that Kawhi Leonard got hurt in game one of the Warriors Spurs series, I am pretty disappointed with what it looks like our lot in the conference finals is going to be.
Yeah,
because I do think I envisioned a world where a fully healthy, you know, locked in Celtics team could at least push the Cavs to six games. And I certainly envisioned a world where, with a healthy Kawhi, the Spurs could throw up a decent challenge to the Warriors. And again, maybe a six game challenge, but six good games. And the fact that it looks like we may get two sweeps without a bunch of good games is pretty disappointing to me.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure why you envisioned a world in which Boston was going to hang with Cleveland, I feel like.
Well, again, hang with is tricky, but Cleveland hasn't defended a good offensive team in months.
Yeah.
So if Boston clicking and Isaiah was really going off, I think they could have – I'm just – maybe a five-game series, but five games played within 10 points.
I don't know. You know? I feel like, you could say Cleveland hadn't defended an offensive team in months, I'd say, except with the exception of when they went into Boston and just destroyed them at the end of the season.
No, I know.
Season.
You're right.
And
the test point that I should have looked at.
Yeah.
But so maybe it was wishful thinking on the Eastern Conference side. But remember, leading up to the playoffs, even though they had that big win in Boston, generally speaking, the Cavs were not playing great. And the fact that they smashed the two teams they smashed, especially when Toronto was mostly without their best player, that didn't completely convince me that they were locked in.
Yeah.
And frankly, I'm not sure this will either. I don't know. I don't know when. I'm not sure how much we'll learn about either of these teams until they play each other.
Right. And also how healthy they wind up being. So, look.
That's the big thing now is it's pretty clear we've got our finals matchup locked in, barring injury. Yeah. So, please, let's just keep everybody healthy.
So, with the caveat that we, are both pretty Warriors invested.
I'm not, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I think you might be. You watch more of the Warriors than anybody else. I think that's at least fair, right?
That stopped being true right around March 1st, but yeah.
Okay.
I watch the Bulls as much as...
Anyway, where do you stand on two-footed closeouts?
I can't believe Greg Popovich went there. I lost respect for him, which I didn't think it was possible.
Can I be on both sides of that? In other words, like I agree with you that he, it was a little bit convenient for him to go there. But I don't think I lost respect for Greg Popovich. I think he was just trying to speak on behalf of his locker room. I think that's how his players felt. And so that's the default position he needed to take in the press.
All right.
You know what I mean? I think it's as simple as that.
Greg Popovich was a guy who demanded the respect of the locker room by doing what he thought was right. He thought was right was excoriating Zaza for a play that, frankly, he had the most serial offender of that play on his team for years and always defended his behavior. Bruce Bowen.
He's got guys doing it in this series, and really everyone does. Everyone has guys who
that's
do
exactly
this.
Right. So the fact that he would suggest there was anything untoward or that Zaza was being inappropriate, like the fact that he would treat it as anything other than a dangerous basketball play that happens. Yeah, I lost a little respect because to me that's kowtowing to somebody. I don't know who. I don't know who he felt like he had to be full of crap to legitimize or stand by, but he was. He was completely full of it, and he knows that. He's smart enough to know that.
Yeah.
So,
but
to me,
and everybody,
I always thought
everyone
Greg
Popovich, loves him, respects him. You know what I mean? So,
what'd you say?
I said he's Pop, and everyone loves and respects him, and I don't think that's changing around this.
Oh, no, and I still love and respect him. The guy is the best coach ever, probably. He's incredible, and I still love almost everything about him.
And I do understand the frustration, and this is kind of how he started framing the rant, was that, like, up until that point, that was a coaching clinic. You know what I mean? Like they were doing the thing, and you know maybe they wouldn't be able to keep up doing the thing. They had some guys who were shooting a little bit better than normal, but defensively, they had all the answers for this team in that game.
Did they?
Yeah. Oh yeah, they did.
Were they playing a team that hadn't played basketball in 15 days?
I mean, look, that I'm sure that helps, but no, they were in all the right spots. They were making all the right switches. It was all doing. They were up 25 points on the best team in basketball on the road, you know. So
the Spurs are great,
and then it all went out the window.
Kawhi,
so you're gonna be a little bit angry after that, I think.
But it was the next day.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You're probably still gonna be angry about the next day because we all know that their chance to win the series is gone now. And you know, they were on
their
the right path.
Their chance to win the series was gone already. I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. And frankly, that just plays into my thinking more. Again, Greg Popovich, one of the greatest ever. Ultimate respect for him, no question. But there's definitely a chink in that armor for me when you see a guy who I really thought would always say what he felt to be the truth, say things that I know he knows aren't true.
I don't know.
I know he knows that.
You got to back your guys. You got to back your guys.
Back your guys, but you don't have to have the most vitriolic press conference you've ever had against a single individual.
Let me ask you this.
Tell me another time Greg Popovich went after a player.
Let me ask you this. I've heard Greg Popovich go after players, although I can't really think of a particular example right now. The Warriors, to a man, no comment in all of this stuff. Like, why didn't anybody defend Zaza?
Clearly someone on both sides. None of the players commented on either side.
Well,
so I don't know what happened.
The Spurs very deliberately, you know, if you listen to Zach Lowe's podcast with Doris Burke this week.
Great podcast, by the way. Yeah. Doris Burke is a hero.
She's great. And she was, you know, working this series and telling the story that the Spurs' responses to a man was Pop speaks for us, which I think kind of goes back to they decided they wanted Pop to go out there and tell this story, and that's what he did.
And again,
I don't know.
I did not think that was the sort of coach Greg Popovich was.
I don't understand what the Warriors' story is because I feel like this is the time when you come to defense of your teammate. You know,
somebody
what I mean?
Obviously,
particularly if he's doing something that everybody's doing. You know what I mean? So
I agree, but someone obviously told him not to say anything. I don't know what that's about.
And I wonder if Zaza's okay with all of that because I would certainly want people rallying around me.
Let me tell you something that I know about Zaza Pachulia. Early in this season, when there were film sessions where they would see Steph or Clay get knocked down and nobody would come to their defense or help them up, Zaza gave an impassioned speech to the team about backing each other up and behaving the right way. So that's the kind of guy Zaza Pachulia is. So yeah, I would venture to guess that he's pretty disturbed.
Yep, I would agree. I would agree. So
and I think he has every right to be.
So,
if I was him, I would be disturbed. Probably, I would probably seek out Greg Popovich to ask what exactly led him down that road, because I would feel persecuted, frankly, by a guy who you say you've seen him go after players. I don't recall him ever calling out an opposing player in this manner ever in his entire career. And to do it after a play that is a classic example of process versus results. It's a process that happens 10 times a game. And the only reason Greg Popovich threw a temper tantrum is because his best player got hurt. Yeah.
So, and by the way, Foul called him a play. You know what I mean? Like, he broke a rule and he received what the NBA has deemed to be the appropriate penalty for breaking that rule. So,
exactly. There's no ground for Popovich to stand on here. Absolutely. And again, this is the thing that just like, it's like, what are you doing? Yeah. I don't get it.
All right. Did we have another sports thing we wanted to get at?
Not that I remember.
All right.
You watch any baseball yet? I haven't.
I've watched a very little bit of baseball, but yeah.
I mean, I lied. I've watched four or five games total.
Yeah, I'm not ready to be there. Sorry, baseball. We'll get to
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Completely agree.
You know, there's plenty of summer where that's all we'll have, and we'll deep dive on it.
Exactly right. Yeah. We're going to be stuck with you all summer, baseball. Just chill out.
Yeah.
Chill out, man. Stop being so thirsty. I would like to demand that you watch some movies before next week.
All right. So, look, in fairness to me, I warned you
busy,
last week. I had
guy.
A lot going on. This week, I have much less. I'm confident that I will see a movie. Are you giving me additional movies, or can I just catch up with Guardians of the Galaxy there?
I mean, Guardians, Colossal was one we had discussed.
All right. You know what? I'll try to see both of those. How's that?
That would be excellent if you managed to see both of those. You know, if you want to get weird, there's also Snatched and King Arthur, neither of which I'm particularly determined to see.
Yeah, I'm going to hard pass on those two.
Okay, so then let's just do Guardians and or Colossal, and then we'll circle back around on Pirates of the Caribbean again in a few weeks when that comes out.
Right.
Maybe Wonder Woman down the road, but let's start with those two. Let's see if you can accomplish that.
Those are bummers, those two. All right.
Wait. Wonder Woman?
Yeah, no, I have zero interest in Wonder Woman.
Pirates, that's right, because you got the – I mean, I knew you wouldn't Pirates, but you got the superhero thing. All right.
Yeah.
I'll see Wonder Woman and tell you all about
that
it.
That sounds good. Will you watch Top of the Lake? I will also try to – because it's been a minute since I've seen it, so if we're going to actually talk about it, I'll probably have to watch it again. I believe it's
what
on Netflix.
What is it? It's just one season?
Yeah. It's not a lot of shows.
And then I mean, I'll do that.
I feel like that's enough.
Yeah, that's enough.
But keep in mind, and you know, if people want to get ahead for things we're going to talk about later, at some point I would like to talk about I Love Dick on Amazon, which I think sounds pretty good.
Wait, what is that?
That is the new show from Jill Soloway, starring Catherine Hahn and Kevin Bacon, on Amazon.
Huh. I thought that was the name of something else.
Well, it's probably the name of a porn or two.
No, I thought it was like, wasn't there a movie?
Maybe there was just
a movie called Dick.
That was like Michelle Williams and like it was about Nixon.
Kirsten Dunst. Yeah. That must be what I'm thinking of.
Oh, you know what? I'm wrong. There are two seasons of Top of the Lake. Sorry about that.
You haven't seen the second season, maybe.
That's correct.
All right. Well, let's all watch season one and see what happens.
Yeah. So you should.
It's allegedly still going.
Yeah. You know, they're working on more. Jane Campion of The Piano is the creator of Top of the Lake. I forgot about that, too.
Oh.
So
cool.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
Peter Mullen. Yeah, I'll watch this.
Yeah, watch some of that. It's good.
I'm a Peter Mullen fan.
Nicole Kidman apparently shows up in season two that I haven't seen yet. That's how I know I haven't seen it.
Her, I could take or leave.
All right. So we got a lot of stuff to watch. You got a lot of stuff to watch. And we'll catch up next week.
Get to work. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.